We're moving toward the middle of the 24th chapter, the evolution of the spiritual man. Sri Aurobindo has been talking about the nature of the evolution and that it is always a double process, the evolution of an outer form and the evolution of the inner consciousness that inhabits the form, and that until there's the full disclosure of the indwelling spirit, there must be a preparation of the vehicle so that it can hold that power of the spirit. Only when the preparation is completed can the realization be secured and the spiritual status established and then extended to the rest of the nature. So it is a process that demands great patience, even as we wake to the possibility, even as we begin the journey that takes us towards spiritual life, life based in the spirit. We must carry with us not only the determination and the fire of the aspiration, but an indefatigable nature committed wholly to the process, however long it takes. To get to that spiritual consciousness is imperative, and our work cannot cease until we achieve that first. All else is based on that. So yes, there's a preparation of the nature, but our first goal as aspirants is to get into that awareness. So we pick up his argument now. In considering the achieved course of the evolution of the spiritual being, we have to regard it from two sides. A consideration of the means, the lines of development utilized by nature, and a view of the actual results achieved by it in the human individual. There are four main lines which nature has followed in her attempt to open up the inner being: religion, occultism, spiritual thought, and an inner spiritual realization and experience. The first three are approaches. The last is the decisive avenue of entry. All these four powers have worked by a simultaneous action, more or less connected, sometimes in a variable collaboration, sometimes in dispute with each other, sometimes in a separate independence. Religion has admitted an occult element in its ritual, ceremony, sacraments. It has leaned upon spiritual thinking, deriving from it sometimes a creed or theology, sometimes it's supporting spiritual philosophy. The former, ordinarily, is the Occidental method, the latter, the Oriental. But spiritual experience is the final aim and achievement of religion, its sky and summit. But also, religion has sometimes banned occultism or reduced its own occult element to a minimum. It has pushed away the philosophic mind as a dry intellectual alien, leaned with all its weight on creed and dogma, pietistic emotion and fervor and moral conduct. It has reduced to a minimum or dispensed with spiritual realization and experience. Occultism has sometimes put forward a spiritual aim as its goal and followed occult knowledge and experience as an approach to it, formulated some kind of mystic philosophy. But more often, it has confined itself to occult knowledge and practice without any spiritual vistas. It has turned to thaumaturgy or mere magic, or even deviated into diabolism, Spiritual philosophy has very usually leaned on religion as its support or its way to experience. It has been the outcome of realization and experience, or built its structures as an approach to it. But it has also rejected all aid or all impediment of religion and proceeded in its own strength, either satisfied with mental knowledge or confident to discover its own path of experience and effective discipline. Spiritual experience has used all the three means as a starting point, but it has also dispensed with them all, relying on its own pure strength, discouraging occult knowledge and powers as dangerous lures and entangling obstacles. It has sought only the pure truth of the Spirit. Dispensing with philosophy, it has arrived instead through the heart's fervor or a mystic inward spiritualization, putting behind it all religious creed, worship, and practice, and regarding them as an inferior stage or first approach, it has passed on, leaving behind it all these supports, nude of all these trappings, to the sheer contact of the spiritual reality. All these variations were necessary. The evolutionary endeavor of nature has experimented on all lines in order to find her true way and her whole way towards the supreme consciousness and the integral knowledge. So all these four, religion, occultism, spiritual thought, philosophy, spiritual experience and realization as the culmination of them all, were necessary to develop the being towards a holistic realization, towards an integral knowledge. For each of these means or approaches corresponds to something in our total being, and therefore to something necessary to the total aim of her evolution. There are four necessities of man's self-expansion if he is not to remain this being of the surface ignorance, seeking obscurely after the truth of things, and collecting and systematizing fragments and sections of knowledge, the small, limited, and half-competent creature of the cosmic force which he now is in his phenomenal nature. First, he must know himself and discover and utilize all his potentialities. Knowledge and power, chit and shakti, hidden at the basis of all reality. He must know himself and discover and utilize all his potentialities. But to know himself and the world completely, he must go behind his own and its exterior. He must dive deep below his own mental surface and the physical surface of nature. This he can only do by knowing his inner mental, vital, physical, and psychic being and its powers and movements, and the universal laws and processes of the occult mind and life which stand behind the material front of the universe. That is the field of occultism, if we take the word in its widest significance. So, just to remind ourselves, occult simply means hidden. There are faces of the universe not visible to the outer eye. There are inner realities, sublimities behind that we can become aware of and grow into, and who have forces and powers available for our discovery and usage. So first, we must reach the profounds behind the surface. That's the field of occultism. He must know also the hidden power or powers that control the world. If there is a cosmic self or spirit or a creator, He must be able to enter into relation with it or him and be able to remain in whatever contact or communion is possible. Get into some kind of tune with the master beings of the universe, or with the universal being and its universal will, or a supreme being and his supreme will. Follow the law it gives him and the assigned or revealed aim of his life and conduct. Raise himself towards the highest height that it demands of him in his life now or in his existence hereafter. If there is no such universal or supreme spirit or being, he must know what there is and how to lift himself to it out of his present imperfection and impotence. This is a very wide statement. So, we must relate to the supreme, to the larger forces of the world. This is the field of religion, and look how he describes it. Cosmic self or spirit, creator, or master beings of the universe. These would be the gods, the devas. Or a universal being, a cosmic spirit. Or a supreme being beyond all. So the forces conscious who populate the cosmos, a universal creator or demiurge or being who would direct those cosmic forces, or more largely still, a transcendent person beyond all the universe, but governing both the universal being and the gods who direct and express the universal will. Or, if it is not a supreme being, still that to which we turn, we must know. What is that ineffable? What is that unnameable reality? And so he says that in according ourselves, in reaching a living communion with these beings or this consciousness in an active in the world, or he or she who is beyond the world, or that which substantiates itself in the world, we have to allow that to, in a sense, direct our steps. We must, through that living communion, allow our actual lives, here and now, today, not hereafter, really, to be expressive of it. And he says, this approach is the aim of religion. Its purpose is to link the human with the divine, and in so doing, sublimate the thought and life and flesh so that they may admit the rule of the soul and spirit. But this knowledge must be something more than a creed or a mystic revelation. His thinking mind must be able to accept it, to correlate it with the principle of things and the observed truth of the universe. This is the work of philosophy, and in the field of the truth of the spirit, it can only be done by a spiritual philosophy, whether intellectual in its method or intuitive. So now we're being led to construct, on the basis of this experience, a rational plan, which is the field of philosophy, that depicts what these realities are to the mind in a way that it can relate to it and be lifted up by it. But all knowledge and endeavor can reach its fruition only if it is turned into experience and has become a part of the consciousness and its established operations. In the spiritual field, all this religious, occult, or philosophical knowledge and endeavor must, to bear fruition, end in an opening up of the spiritual consciousness, in experiences that found and continually heighten, expand, and enrich that consciousness, and in the building of a life and action that is in conformity with the truth of the Spirit. This is the work of spiritual realization and experience. So to think about it, to delve behind, all of these steps are important, but that must be experienced, and this is its field. To build a life conforming with the Spirit's truth is our real mission as spiritual aspirants. In the very nature of things, all evolution must proceed at first by a slow unfolding. For each new principle that evolves its powers has to make its way out of an involution in inconscience and ignorance. It has a difficult task in pulling itself out of the involution, out of the hold of the obscurity of the original medium, against the pull and strains, the instinctive opposition and obstruction of the inconscience, and the hampering mixture and blind, obstinate retardations of the ignorance. Nature affirms at first a vague urge and tendency, which is a sign of the push of the occult, subliminal, submerged reality towards the surface. There are then small, half-suppressed hints of the thing that is to be. Imperfect beginnings, crude elements, rudimentary appearances, small, insignificant, hardly recognizable quanta. Afterwards, there are small or large formations. A more characteristic and recognizable quality begins to show itself, first partially, here and there, or in a low intensity, then more vivid, more formative. Finally, there is the decisive emergence, a reversal of the consciousness, the beginning of the possibility of its radical change. But still, much has to be done in every direction. A long and difficult growth towards perfection lies before the evolutionary endeavor. The thing done has not only to be confirmed, secured against relapse and the downward gravitation, against failure and extinction, but opened out into all the fields of its possibilities, its totality of entire self-achievement, its utmost height, subtlety, riches, wideness. It has to become dominant, all-embracing, comprehensive. This is everywhere the process of nature, and to ignore it is to miss the intention in her works and get lost in the maze of her procedure. So he's described the general process of evolution here, that we evolve out of an involved inconscience, what seems utter blackness, discontinuity, suppression of all awareness. Slowly, something comes. First, there is an urge. Then a small beginning, as he says. Later, a larger formation. Finally, a decisive emergence. It is this process that has taken place in the evolution of religion in the human mind and consciousness. The work done by it for humanity cannot be understood or properly appreciated if we ignore the conditions of the process and their necessity. It is evident that the first beginnings of religion must be crude and imperfect, its development hampered by mixtures, errors, concessions to the human mind and vital part, which may often be of a very unspiritual character. Ignorant and injurious and even disastrous elements may creep in and lead to error and evil. The dogmatism of the human mind, its self-assertive narrowness, the intolerant and challenging egoism, its attachment to its limited truths and still greater attachment to its errors, or the violence, fanaticism, militant and oppressive self-affirmation of the vital, its treacherous action on the mind in order to get a sanction for its own desires and propensities, may very easily invade the religious field and balk religion of its higher spiritual aim and character. Under the name of religion, much ignorance may hide, many errors and extensive wrong building be permitted, many crimes even, and offenses against the spirit be committed. But this checkered history belongs to all human effort, and if it were to count against the truth and necessity of religion, would count also against the truth and necessity of every other line of human endeavor, against all man's actions, his ideals, his thought, his art, his science. It has become popular to vilify religion these days when we assert, no, we are no longer religious, now we are spiritual and we're beyond religion. Not so fast. No doubt all these things have populated religion, have deformed it and defaced it. He has described religion as is our common experience. But so too, if we look at the field of art and science and philosophy, we find similar disfigurations in those fields. It seems to be the nature of humanity. Is there a utility in religion? Let's get to it. Religion has opened itself to denial by its claim to determine the truth by divine authority, by inspiration, by a sacrosanct and infallible sovereignty given to it from on high. It has sought to impose itself on human thought, feeling, conduct, without discussion or question. This is an excessive and premature claim. Although imposed in a way on the religious idea by the imperative and absolute character of the inspirations and illuminations which are its warrant and justification, and by the necessity of faith as an occult light and power from the soul amidst the mind's ignorance, doubts, weakness, incertitudes. We do get inspirations. We do have an unquenchable faith. They are necessary. If they have formed something which has become ossified in religion, we must do something about that. But that is core to its truth. Faith is indispensable to man, for without it he could not proceed forward in his journey through the unknown. But it ought not to be imposed. It should come as a free perception or an imperative direction from the inner spirit. A claim to unquestioned acceptance could only be warranted if the spiritual effort had already achieved man's progression to the highest truth consciousness, total and integral, free from all ignorant mental and vital mixture. This it cannot claim. This is the ultimate object before us, but it has not yet been accomplished, and the premature claim has obscured the true work of the religious instinct in man, which is to lead him towards the divine reality, to formulate all that he has yet achieved in that direction, and to give to each human being a mold of spiritual discipline, a way of seeking, touching, nearing the divine truth, a way which is proper to the potentialities of his nature. So to make an absolute claim, as if they have the sovereignty with which to do it, and say, this is true, and this only is true, is improper. That can only be a fiat imposed upon us by a supramental consciousness, which instead would be opening us to the infinite in all directions and showing how each path leads to its complete being. The wide and supple method of evolutionary nature, providing the amplest scope and preserving the true intention of the religious seeking of the human being, can be recognized in the development of religion in India, where any number of religious formulations, cults, and disciplines have been allowed, even encouraged, to subsist side by side. And each man was free to accept and follow that which was congenial to his thought, feeling, temperament, build of the nature. It is right and reasonable that there should be this plasticity, proper to an experimental evolution. For religion's real business is to prepare man's mind, life, and bodily existence for the spiritual consciousness to take it up. It has to lead him to that point where the inner spiritual light begins fully to emerge. It is at this point that religion must learn to subordinate itself, not to insist on its outer characters, but give full scope to the inner spirit itself to develop its own truth and reality. In the meanwhile, it has to take up as much of man's mentality, vitality, physicality as it can, and give all his activities a turn towards the spiritual direction, the revelation of a spiritual meaning in them, the imprint of a spiritual refinement, the beginning of a spiritual character. It is in this attempt that the errors of religion come in, for they are caused by the very nature of the matter with which it is dealing. That inferior stuff invades the very forms that are meant to serve as intermediaries between the spiritual and the mental, vital, or physical consciousness, and often it diminishes, degrades, and corrupts them. But it is in this attempt that lies religion's greatest utility as an intercessor between spirit and nature. Truth and error live always together in the human evolution, and the truth is not to be rejected because of its accompanying errors, though these have to be eliminated. Often a difficult business, and if crudely done, resulting in surgical harm inflicted on the body of religion. For what we see as error is very frequently the symbol or a disguise or a corruption or malformation of a truth which is lost in the brutal radicality of the operation. The truth is cut out along with the error. Nature herself very commonly permits the good corn and the tares and weeds to grow together for a long time, because only so is her own growth, her free evolution, possible. So we can see in the complexity and the sophistication of religious phenomena in India the true intention of what religion is supposed to achieve. We must, he tells us, integrate the whole being and then to direct it towards this spiritual experience and essential reality. We must eliminate the error in religion, but not eliminate religion itself, because there is an impulse in it which is true and which serves an ultimate good. We should not cancel the truth that lies behind. There is a reality that religion is seeking behind the surfaces of the world, and we must give pursuit to that reality. we can eschew the errors, its faults, all the things that beset it along the way, and we must. So we'll continue with Sri Aurobindo's examination of the evolutionary nature next week when we take up the Life Divine again. We'll put a bookmark there this time and turn to Savitri for some light, which is pertinent to what we've been reading, I think, tonight. This is drawn from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief. Their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies, the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means the spirit's acolytes. A heavenlier function with a finer mode lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self, into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's force, releasing things unseized by earthly sense, a world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true, and all that the life longs for is drawn close. Namaste. Jai Ma.